Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Welcome to today's Omfit podcast on the third wave of fintech innovation. We are delighted to be joined by Usman Ahmed, Head of Global Public Policy and Research at PayPal, and Ivy Lau, Lead Manager, Global Public Policy and Research at PayPal also. I am Patricia Haas Cleveland, U.S. President of OMFIF. Welcome, Usman and Ivy. Tell us a little bit about what your team does at PayPal, what kind of research projects you do. And also, your title is very inviting to ask the question, there must be two other waves of fintech innovation that's already gone on. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that as well, when they took place and what they were about. And are we indeed on the cusp of a third wave? So over to you. Ivy, maybe you want to start.
Thank you for having us, Patricia. I'll start with talking a bit about what our team does and what kind of research projects we focus on. I like to think of our role as being bilingual. So on one hand, we help internal stakeholders inside PayPal understand the broader environment. And on the other hand, we help external stakeholders in the broader environment understand PayPal. And we prioritize what's material and important and significant to our company and our sector. And we get to work with people like yourself and organizations like OMFIF, and we get to engage in the world of applied research. That means we're constantly learning new ideas, participating in discussions and clarifications, and going really deep into the complexities and nuances and understanding their implications. And the process of creating and sharing knowledge and insights is really fun, and hopefully we'll get a taste of it talking about the third wave of fintech innovation and the examples of our other research projects focus on socioeconomic impact of our products and services. So on our website, you will find papers on the impact of working capital, remittances, giving, et cetera. And I'll pass it over to you, Usman, to talk a bit about the other two waves of fintech innovation.
Thanks, Ivy, and thanks, Patricia and OMFIF for hosting us and calling out the provocative title, Third Wave of Fintech Innovation. We spent a lot of time thinking about that title, in part because obviously everything we think about these days is surrounded by the overlay of COVID, and we've had a lot of waves of COVID. And so we were a little sensitive to that in thinking about the title, but we're hoping we're coming out of that. So we decided to go with the word wave. But when you think about the third, obviously there had to have been a first and a second. And so our kind of thesis was driven by the idea that it's not just technology that drives fintech, but really a slew of factors. And so thinking certainly about technological developments, but also, business models and business developments, and then also macro factors like government and policy and social developments. We really analyzed all of those when thinking about these various waves. So if we think about, the first wave, we really kind of zeroed in on the time of the mid-90s and early 2000s, where you had a combination of technological developments in the form of the commercialization of the internet and the kind of broader uptake of personal computing, largely in Western countries, but somewhat around the world. And at the same time, you had a dot-com bubble from a macro financial perspective, which certainly, informed the development of the wave. And then you had, new businesses and new business models, certainly PayPal, our company, would have fit into that time frame, but also companies like Xero, companies like Zoom, Ivy mentioned remittances, globally, you Ant Financial was started around that time. And so you had some really exciting early developments, I would argue, in fintech occurring at that time. And then certainly the one that's probably been written about and covered and thought about a lot more is the second wave. Namely around, the macro phenomenon of the 2008 financial crisis, but also, technology-wise, the kind of rise of the smartphone and the massive proliferation of the internet globally. So, those sets of factors really drove another wave of business model innovation. Companies you might think of like SoFi or Acorns, Venmo, again, global companies, many of which started up in that time, the kind of rise of embedded finance and companies in other sectors offering financial services also was the phenomenon at that time. And so now, thinking about the where we are today and why we think we might be on the cusp of a third wave, certainly again, macro phenomenon of COVID where I just started, occurring during the last couple of years, certainly driving a wave of digitization. I think, the numbers just came out from the ITU about a significant percentage increase in the number of people who are connected to the internet over the last 2 years. And that certainly being a potential opportunity with this, new group of people who are joining, new methods and technologies for people to be accessing financial services. And then new companies that are as always rising up in this space. And so that's kind of the context for why we think we might be at this next wave of innovation. And the study was really about trying to unpack that a bit and understand it a bit better.
Well, it's interesting. You almost sounded tentative to use the word COVID because everybody wants it to be over. And is it kind of a one-off, black swan? But actually, so many interesting things happened around COVID, aside from sort of the social implications, but it was a time for a lot of people to rethink how they do things. And it also very much accelerated the trend that was already there before COVID towards digitization. So you really had already a path towards innovation. You already had people changing their ways or rethinking their ways, but a lot of this got accelerated. And we really see it if you look particularly at the case of money and how people were using money. So as part of the rethink that folks had during COVID about money, it's interesting to see where their thinking is both now and going forward. And you did this big survey with 4,000 individuals across 4 different countries, and you focused on this question of cash. So what did you find out from respondents' attitudes towards cash? And then let's just take that a step one further, which is, what about digital currencies? What is the thinking there? And also, again, you have the intersection of the regulatory world with the finance world. So you've got policymakers as well as industry players. So can you tell us a little bit about what came out of that survey? And then what are the implications for, say, central bank digital currencies going forward?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in on that. Thanks, Patricia. So as you mentioned, a survey of 4,000 people across the US, China, Brazil, and Germany. And again, we really wanted to think about context. And, if you read articles from the late 90s, early 2000s, you would have seen a bunch of articles that said the death of cash is imminent. And then if you read articles in the late 2000s, the death of cash is imminent. And, to your point, what could have been a more macro phenomenon to drive the death of cash than everybody having to be inside of their houses and having to transact? And what our survey showed is certainly, yes, a majority of respondents across all of the markets were using less cash now than they were pre-pandemic. And a majority said that they wanted to use less cash going forward. So again, not a particularly surprising finding there given the macro phenomenon, but a solid minority indicated that they wanted to actually use cash more in 2021. And so some of that could be attributed to the point of we've been cooped up in our houses and we want to get out and engage with the physical world. But, 1 in 5 of our respondents saying they wanted to use more cash in 2021 was a notable finding, in part because of the reasons I think that people were saying they wanted to use cash. And it was the following kind of items were ticked as reasons for people using cash. The idea that it has no fees, that it's usable anywhere, that you're able to better control your spending, and anonymity were all kind of marked as reasons why cash as a form of money was important and usable. And, you know, comparing that to folks who said why they use digital payments, many of them cited convenience, flexibility, safety as reasons. So different reasons. So it's almost like these two payment instruments are providing different value sets or kind of hitting different communities with different choices. And that's going to be kind of a reiterant theme that we're going to come through in this discussion, I think, is the optionality and the consumer choice and the consumer demand is what drives why people use certain things. And so I'll let Ivy jump in to talk about the digitization of currencies and digital currencies. But really, again, it was, you know, cash still has a role to play. It's certainly, you know, becoming a smaller percentage of the overall payments landscape. But, until, you know, I would preface the discussion on digital currencies by saying, you know, there is an opportunity for digital currency to fill some of that need that cash seems to continue to be providing in the economy. Over to you, Ivy.
Thanks, Usman. Yeah, I think a good way to maybe summarize what we found and learned on cash and digital currencies is that cash is still king, but the future is cashless. We found that more than half of respondents said that they are very excited about a cashless future. And more specifically, 79% of respondents in Brazil and 72% in China said they like the idea of not having to carry cash or coins. And the percentage is also fairly high in the US and in Germany. And more specifically, when we asked them about the likelihood of using new government issued money that is secure, digital, and usable online and everywhere cash is accepted, we know that CBDC is an evolving construct, and that was the best way we could describe it and get a feel for what people think. An overwhelming majority of them indicated readiness. And we're talking about 99% in China, not surprisingly, 92% in Brazil, 77% in Germany, and 73% in the US. So I think that's a pretty strong indicator that the future is trending cashless. But another nuance we want to throw in there is that in the markets that are more reliant on legacy systems, such as Germany and US, the enthusiasm for CBDC does not necessarily apply to digital identity, which is a likely precondition for the general usage of CBDC. And you know, in fact, over 70% of respondents in the US and Germany, which is a very high percentage, would prefer carrying a physical driver's license instead of a digital license on a smartphone. And that's the opposite of what we found in China and Brazil, where most people would favor a digital license. And you asked about implications for policymakers and industry players. We think it might just mean a greater readiness for digital solutions in China and Brazil, and in markets with legacy systems, the comfort with digital payments may apply to the notion of a central bank digital currency, but not necessarily to digital ID. And so we think it means more forward-leaning digital ID framework is necessary for our broader infrastructure upgrade and more education and marketing from both public and private sectors with regards to digital ID in US and Germany will probably be really helpful. And the reasons for using cash and the reasons for using digital payments that Usman highlighted earlier are also very important to keep in mind, because these are the benefits that are important to users. And therefore, when a CBD DC is being designed, I think it's important to take all of those features into consideration, because I think that is what will satisfy expectations about financial services and what would promote trust in innovation.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that it's not implicit, I mean, you didn't really say it, but I think it's interesting, it's the demographics. You tend to have younger populations in Brazil and China. They are much more comfortable and at home with digital. You have older populations in the US and Germany. They are less comfortable, and that may be also tilting the results, but if cash is king and the future is cashless, I think if you look at right now, you see a mix, but the future is going to be the demographics, the younger people. And I think that will also be supportive of, you know, this trend that you're talking about, and maybe more comfort with digital IDs, which is, I'm glad you raised. It's an important point that we hear about a lot in the discussion of a CBDC in the U.S. If we look at the third wave, technology has indeed continued to evolve quite rapidly, and we've seen much greater use of AI and machine learning. There's all sorts of new developments on the tech front. So I'd like to talk also about that, as well as the bundling and unbundling. And I think bundling and unbundling may also have to do with a generational issue. As people get older, they may like bundled services. As they're younger, they might like unbundled, where they can sort of surf the net and find the best deals. But tell us a little bit about what you found around bundling and unbundling, and then also what you found out about automated financial services and the trend. You know, is everything going to be on autopilot in finance? That's a bit of a loaded question, but we'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on that.
Thank you, Patricia. I love the question. Of will the future of fintech be defined by bundling or unbundling? Because I like to say yes. A little tongue in cheek, but I think the jury is out, actually. And I like to quote Jim Barksdale, the former CEO of Netscape, and he said this, it's really profound insight. There are two ways to make money in business. One is to bundle and the other is to unbundle. And we have seen that, especially with the arrival of internet and mobile technologies. We've seen that in a whole host of sectors, and both bundling and unbundling have been taking place in financial services too. And I won't go too much into the history, but, you know, I'll just sketch out the outline real quick to map what Usman described earlier about the first and the second waves. Like, traditionally, banks have functioned as the supermarket for consumer financial services for decades, until I think with the first wave of fintech companies, they emerged with new approaches to solve for specific financial needs in the late 90s and early 2000s. So Zoom specialized in digital cross-border remittances, for example. And Yodlee, which is a data aggregation and analytic platform, they saw the opportunity to help companies unbundle and port data from financial services providers to provide more tailored offerings. And so in late 1990s and early 2000s, we saw that banks were no longer the only option for payments, loans and credit, insurance, et cetera, et cetera. And it's the same with the second wave. After the global financial crisis in 2008, the number of companies in what used to be traditional bank verticals also grew rapidly. SoFi was founded as a student loan lender, for example, and like Usman said, Venmo became synonymous with peer-to-peer transfer not too long after its first transaction. And so when we asked respondents in these four markets about their preferences and behaviors around bundling and unbundling, the survey data actually came back with a lack of consensus and clarity around what they prefer. The similar percentage of people prefer having all their money with one financial institution as a percentage of people who prefer to have their money with multiple financial institutions. And that's true in US, Brazil, and Germany, and China. In fact, a higher percentage of respondents in China prefer having money in multiple financial institutions, as opposed to having all of them in one financial institution. And that's maybe a little bit counterintuitive for a market that is known to have super apps. The other nuance, what we discover though, is that the preference for bundling might actually be considerably stickier than preference for unbundling across markets. It's a mouthful. But people who have bundled financial services have very little desire to unbundle. So less than 10% of them in every market we surveyed, and that's in contrast with a much higher percentage of respondents who are currently using multiple providers would prefer to consolidate. And there are different reasons for relying on multiple financial institutions and apps. And it's not entirely clear, why the jury is still out. And it's not entirely clear whether policy will steer the trends in a particular direction. Some public policy issues, including open banking and concerns about market concentration, they point to more competition and unbundling. But other policy choices, such as narrow application of licensure and existing requirements, could potentially reduce competition and drive bundling. So there is still a lot to learn, but what we know is that bundling and unbundling are both proven ways to succeed in the market, and fintech seems to be another example that proves the rule. Usman, what do you think about automation? What do we learn?
Thanks, Ivy. Let me jump in on that. Patricia, a little bit of a counterintuitive finding, just like with cash. You know, like you said, it seems like everything around us is automating very quickly. But I think to preface the findings, I think just like in the discussion around cash, it comes down to providing the consumer with the ultimate choice and the capability to do and achieve what they want to achieve with their financial services. That's the insight, I think, from the findings I'm about to share, which are that across all of the markets that we surveyed, we found that a surprisingly low percentage of people were automating, for example, debt repayments. But we asked across a number of different financial services offerings, have you kind of set them on autopilot? And the answers across the board were surprisingly low. And so that, again, led us to a question of what is the reason for that? First of all, it could be a mismatch between preferences and behavior. So certainly we do know that quite a few consumers kind of opt into or even choose automation of services. But when we asked for the sentiment of what is it that would enable you to kind of trust as kind of a key term that we use across this study, automation more, the respondents' answers were really about increased education. In China, for example, which arguably is the most mature fintech market that we studied, the 80% of the respondents said they wanted more education about digital payments. 50% of the respondents in China said that they didn't feel comfortable enough with smartphone technology for financial transactions. Again, we know that, the vast majority of people in China are using these services, but they're still saying, I still don't feel entirely comfortable handing over everything to the service. And so that's a gap that, or an opportunity really for financial services providers to further automate, certainly. And that is, seems like it's incredibly likely to happen. That more and more of these services will become embedded, more and more of these services will be, combined, data will be used to enhance the service offerings. But can that be done in concert with providing consumers a greater level of control, a greater level of choice, a greater level of flexibility. This is a fundamental kind of challenge that I think providers in this space are going to be faced with moving into this next wave, because, you know, even though consumers are choosing the automation, they're also reflecting a notion that they want to continue to maintain control over their financial lives in this automated future.
Well, as you have said previously in your comments, it all comes down to what is easy for the consumer, what can they trust, what is most convenient. And when products are created that satisfy that, they tend to go with the innovation, but it can be a long road to understand it and to move in that direction. And again, I have to think demographics has something to do with it, that the older you are, the more reluctant you may be to change, which are the populations in Germany and the U.S. The younger you are, the more open you might be, such as in China and Brazil. But let's jump to the last questions. I see the clock is ticking. We just have a few more minutes to sort of say, if we had a crystal ball, let's look ahead. So we actually, as I understand it, in the pandemic, we discovered a lot of things. And one of the things that was really highlighted was that financial services, the traditional financial services have not really served very well a number of folks in the population, particularly the unbanked and the underbanked. And so as we look ahead and to some of the gains we're seeing in technologies, do you think that this, you know, may change? And also, how do you think the regulatory frameworks will evolve to meet the needs of the customers, financial infrastructure, and all the pressure that financial services face as a result of change coming into the economy? I want to just add one note that I was struck by that you noticed, which said that one in every $5 invested by venture capital in 2021 has gone into fintech. I think that's very encouraging to see the industry evolve, and there's a lot of creativity in fintech. So looking and taking a step back and looking at some of these issues, how are you thinking about what's ahead?
Yeah, thank you, Patricia. I would also add another interesting stat is that almost one in every $5 of retail sales is now e-commerce globally. Mm-hmm. Just really kind of pinpointing the fact that digitization accelerated a lot because of the pandemic. And that means increasing importance of payment security. And in the US and around the world, we also saw the importance of timely disbursement of G2P payments at scale. All that to say, I think there is a tremendous opportunity to upgrade our financial infrastructure. And the one thing that I think we want to really drive home is, as we consider and take hold of this opportunity to upgrade our system, and I love that you asked a question about the underserved. We have a huge, huge opportunity to expand our focus from traditional notions of financial inclusion to a much, much broader goal of universal financial health. And so when we think about technology and regulations, and all the pieces that go into modernizing our financial system, we ought to think about how we can make it more affordable and efficient and inclusive for everyone, because financial health is something that concerns everyone. Of all, you know, I love that you really notice the demographics, you know, of all generations, all stages of life, of all socioeconomic strata. We all have, opportunities to build resilience, to take hold of dreams and hopes we want to realize in the future and to fully participate in the digitizing economy. So I think a huge focus we have at PayPal is like how we can make it work for everyone. So it's yes and. The financially excluded and the underserved, financial inclusion and financial health. Over to you, Usman.
Yeah, no, I'll just put a few numbers to support exactly what you said. I mean, you know, it's well known that the 1.7 billion people around the world lack access to basic financial services, but many, you know, our RCO regularly says like many billions more are underserved, right? And I, for those who were brave enough to listen to the end of this podcast, I mentioned at the start, you know, some new numbers that came out today from the International Telecommunications Union about connectivity to the internet. And just to share those concretely, in 2019, 54% of people were connected to the internet, and 2021 we're at 63%. So quite a rise, but still there's a huge gap there. And again, what we know from our other research at PayPal is that digital technology is incredibly helpful for increasing access to financial health. It's able to offer services and products that were traditionally, you know, limited to a select few, to a lot greater amount of people, able to leverage data to offer services in a cheaper, faster, more efficient, more secure way. So in thinking about 2022 going forward, certainly that question of enhancing financial health for all is central to, I think, what we're thinking about at PayPal. And also, you know, I know OMFIF does tremendous work on some of the issues that kind of ladder up to that, whether that's trusted AI systems that are going to enable some of those breakthrough innovations, whether that's cybersecurity, whether that's, you know, central bank digital currency and digital currency more generally. Some of these innovations that are occurring on the technological side, just to try to wrap everything up here as we're ending, we want to make sure that those are mirrored or connected with really some of the developments occurring on the business model side and on the policy and regulatory and socioeconomic development sides. That's really the opportunity, I think, that stands before us in 2022, and going forward, is figuring out how to take some of these exciting technology trends and again ensure that they are being used in a way that really drives that goal of enhanced financial health for everybody. That's really what we're focused on our team at the company, and I hope in the broader industry.
Well, thank you for that, Usman. I think that's a fantastic context to put our discussion into, that both you and Ivy really reiterated. And by taking a step back, I think people can see the importance of the big picture as well as what's going on the micro level. At the end of the day, so much as a practical matter is indeed around payments and the ability of people around the world at all levels to get access to cheap, you know, efficient and accessible payment systems. And so for the innovation and the technology that's going underway that helps make that happen, I think that's a very pragmatic, tactical way to help achieve these broader goals. But these broader goals are what's really critical, I think everybody would agree with. I think that's about it for our time. I want to thank you very much. It's great study, great comments and observations. We're going to stay tuned for 2022 and hope that you've got an equally exciting piece on what the third wave ended up being all about. But good luck and thanks again.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.